You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The counterinsurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan have forced the U.S. military to rethink how it fights wars and declares victory. The former military mentality of going into a country, fighting the enemy, and pulling out has been replaced by one where soldiers often assume the responsibilities of building roads, schools, and power plants, all the while trying to bridge the cultural divide. In his new book, Armed Humanitarians, The Rise of the Nation Builders, Nathan Hodge, a staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal, explains how the shift to so-called armed social work became a basic part of American military strategy. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased to welcome Nathan Hodge to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Is this idea of nation building a natural result of the types of wars we've been fighting over the past few decades?
Part of it is a rediscovery of some of the lessons of earlier wars. I write a little bit about how in 2005, when the U.S. military was really undergoing this sort of exercise in self-flagellation as to why they were losing so badly in Iraq, they went back and rediscovered a lot of the lessons from Vietnam. And they rediscovered a new narrative of the Vietnam War, which was that the reason that sort of in their view, by the early 1970s, the United States was winning. And it was winning because it had wholeheartedly embraced this hearts and minds counterinsurgency approach to warfare. And they went back and sort of reread this literature in somewhat of a self-serving way, and decided that this was something, these were lessons that they needed to go back and revive.
But this is something that the military resists, isn't it? They don't like building roads, doing all sorts of things like making sure that the generator is working for some little town.
I'd argue in some ways that they took really enthusiastically to it, because in some ways it's a gratifying mission. I would go out just as often on what they would call HA drop, humanitarian assistance drops. You would go to visit a school. There would be an engagement, which is their term for meeting with a local leader. And this was something that they very often described as a satisfying job, more than what they call the kinetic.
Wasn't George W. Bush's initial position not to support a nation-building policy?
Yeah, absolutely. In 2000, when he was running in debate with Al Gore, he said, "I don't think the United States should be in the business of nation-building." Of course, by the end of his term, he had supported the creation of a new nation-building corps.
Although we don't call it nation-building, do we?
No, nation-building is
one
of those.
Are we just doing it and calling something else?
You'll get some people, for instance, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates likes to use the term, or has used the term, nation building under fire. I've also heard it described by David Kilcullen, one of the gurus of counterinsurgency, as armed social work. But nation building is a term that's one of those really unsatisfying ones, and that's deliberately why I chose to use it.
Has the Obama administration continued or expanded the nation-building approach?
Interesting. Again, there's been a reluctance to claim ownership for that term, nation-building. When President Obama announced that there was going to be a surge of forces to Afghanistan to bolster our effort there, he said, "I want to make it clear that the nation I'm most interested in building is our own. That being said, we are committing massive amounts of treasure, energy, and manpower to this nation-building project in Afghanistan."
What's been the diplomatic community's position vis-a-vis the Obama approach?
It was frustrating, I think, for everyone involved to see how the State Department, U.S. Agency for International Development, which are really, really small organizations compared to the military, have been sort of dragooned into this mission, and very often they don't have the manpower to deal with it, and they had the same problem in Iraq.
Well, let's go back to Vietnam, which you do spend considerable time in your book looking at. So in Vietnam, you say that we engaged in nation building. We left that country with our tail between our legs. And wasn't Afghanistan called the Soviet Union's Vietnam?
That's correct. But interestingly enough, again in 2005, let's say, when counterinsurgency started to come back and in vogue in the U.S. military, they were really groping for solutions. And one of the things that they did turn to was, again, it was a narrative of the Vietnam War, which said that, you know, prior to 1975, let's say in 1972, 1973, the United States had prevailed in a counterinsurgency. But Vietnam ultimately collapsed, in part because, again, there's a narrative that the U.S. Will evaporated and funding stopped South Vietnam.
And we've had this experience elsewhere as well, in Bosnia, Kosovo.
But those were very sort of small-scale nation-building experiments compared to what we've seen, just if you measure it in terms of sheer dollar value.
Is nation-building in Afghanistan going to be successful without some kind of peace agreement with the Taliban?
Ultimately, what counterinsurgency theory tells you is that without any kind of political settlement, you can't succeed at all. So the idea is that these strategies are really a way of buying time.
Also, isn't the Taliban trying to sabotage any attempt of this sort? We just had a report this morning out of Afghanistan that the Taliban had a suicide bomber kill at least 31 people in Kunduz province, which is in the north and not Taliban territory.
I'd actually argue in many cases our nation-building efforts are sabotaging ourselves by enabling groups like the Taliban to create channels or streams of funding. I talk a little bit about in the book about Kunduz province. I visited there when the Germans were first setting up one of these experimental teams called the Provincial Reconstruction Team, which was basically this interesting case of the merger between a sort of humanitarian aid work, development work, and military action. This is supposed to be the template for success in Afghanistan, creating these hybrid civil-military teams. But the problem was, number one, it really, really, for people who are from the traditional world of aid and development, we're really concerned that this might, number one, undermine the neutrality of people who are delivering aid and create problems for them, make it less safe for them to work because they typically aren't armed. And the second problem that we would create is when we have all these massive amounts, when we turn on a fire hose of aid and development money, we create enormous opportunities for corruption that can become a funding stream for the insurgency itself.
My guest is Nathan Hodge. His latest book, Armed Humanitarians, The Rise of the Nation Builders. It's published by Bloomsbury. Let's talk about those other people who come in to help. We're not talking about NGOs here, but they were bringing in all sorts of scientists embedded, anthropologists.
This was one of the more fascinating experiments and one I actually got to see firsthand in Iraq in 2008. These were called the Human Terrain System or the Human Terrain Teams. The idea was it was a way of remedying.
Why human terrain? Forgive me for asking that.
It was the way, again, it's sort of, you've got to get a little bit around the military jargon here, but it was a way of understanding that human terrain, the cultures that you operate in, as much as you could take a look at a map and understand the actual geography that you are working in. So the idea of the human terrain was mastering that trickiest part for the counterinsurgent, for the nation builder. That's understanding the human factor.
And there was a couple that ran into a bit of problems as a result. Can you tell us the story of Don Ayala and Paula Lloyd?
Paula Lloyd was a member of a human terrain team in Afghanistan. She was out on a patrol. Now, this is the interesting thing, was the idea was that you would embed social scientists, anthropologists, ethnographers, and they would provide cultural advice to the military in the field and help them bridge the gap and identify the people they needed to make friends with. Paula Lloyd had gone and approached someone, a local man, who it's still unclear why, but doused her with some kind of flammable liquid, set her on fire. She died a couple of months later of the burns. But what happened was that a member of her team, after the Afghan Haman had been captured and had been handcuffed, essentially, he went and shot him in the head. He was later convicted of deliberately killing this prisoner. And it was just one of a series of public relations disasters, and not just public relations, real tragedies that had been associated with this program. The problem wasn't just that they had bad PR. The problem was that a number of the social scientists involved with this, some of them very idealistic people, like I mentioned Michael Bhatia, he was very much the poster child for the program, somebody who really went in with eyes open and was very aware of the ethical minefields potentially, or the real ones as well, died also early on in the program.
Did events like this eventually lead to the scaling down of the human terrain teams?
No, the human terrain system is still there, and I think it's become a very attractive model when the military starts looking at the future, when it looks at places like Africa. And I talk a little bit in the book about the creation of U.S. Africa Command, which is a military geographic command that's based in Germany but focused exclusively on Africa. And they also envision this as being sort of a hybrid command that's also going to be involved in development work and these very non-traditional, non-military kinds of missions.
Well, they haven't been doing all that well in Djibouti and the Côte d'Ivoire.
Well, originally the mission in Djibouti was set up purely as just a counterterrorism mission. It wasn't set up to be something more than what it is, but it becomes, again, there are a couple of concepts. A military term would be mission creep. They start to look for other missions to do, and that's when they start to embrace more of these missions that I'd call the armed humanitarian mission.
Well, we have these anthropologists, but there are other people as well, the so-called civil affairs troops. Who are they?
Civil affairs is they're sort of the dedicated nation builders along with special forces within the military themselves. Most of them are reservists, so they actually have civilian jobs. And their job is to basically go back, go on the battlefield and sort of clean up afterwards. They are the ones who are responsible for, you know, say, for instance, you have an airstrike or you have some kind of, you know, heavily a violence operation in some kind of area. Well, their job is to go in and make sure that things get cleaned up, that roads get repaved, that electricity gets restored. They're really sort of the dedicated social workers of the military. But they are such a small and underfunded, historically speaking, segment of the military, and they have been ones who have been sort of tasked to do a lot of these jobs.
And then the military has to watch them and keep them safe.
Well,
are they a liability on some level?
No, they're soldiers, and they're also trained. They're trained to defend themselves. The bigger problem came when the military wanted to bring in civilians who really weren't trained to be in a combat zone. You're talking about your foreign service officers, your USAID,
and that
people.
Happened right away when after the invasion, when the Coalition Provisional Authority was created. Suddenly, half the young Republicans in Washington seemed to be shipped in to Baghdad.
And people sort of who really didn't have a whole lot of professional experience ended up occupying very senior positions in this occupational authority. But that also created another problem, which was once you've got this mass of civilian advisors and experts who are moving around in a very dangerous place, how do you protect them? Well, obviously, there weren't enough troops to do that job. So you started to, well, outsource. So
that's where Blackwater came.
That's where companies like Blackwater came in. They were filling a massive need. These were pretty niche and obscure companies 10 years ago. We wouldn't have heard of any of them. You know, the creation of the CPA created an explosion of demand for their services.
And who was watching Blackwater? This seemed to be a big problem. We had a separate private military operating in Iraq.
This was something,
and to some degree in Afghanistan as well.
And to a degree in Afghanistan as well. In a lot of ways, the State Department just didn't really have any kind of expertise or experience overseeing such a large number of armed people. The Bureau of Diplomatic Service, the Bureau of Diplomatic Security. They're the ones who are sort of the in-house providers of sort of bodyguard services for diplomats. They just weren't large enough for the mission, and they weren't used to overseeing a force that grew and is still growing. Interestingly enough, if we look at Iraq today, the conversation is talking about withdrawing all U.S. troops as per the U.S.-Iraq agreement by the end of this year. But they're looking to supplement the U.S. mission with an army of several thousand private contractors, something that doesn't get talked about very much.
You talk to the soldiers. What did they say? They're trained to go and fight a war.
They are. But I think a lot of them have taken, again, to this idea of sitting down and drinking the three cups of tea. It's interesting to see how something sort of from popular culture has resonated with them in a military that's dedicated to fighting and winning wars.
My guest is Nathan Hodge. His book, Armed Humanitarians, The Rise of the Nation Builders, is published by Bloomsbury. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Nathan Hodge, who's a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He has written extensively about the Middle East and the former Soviet Union and is the author with Sharon Weinberger of Nuclear Family Vacation. He's also written for Slate, The Financial Times, Foreign Policy, other publications. And his new book is called Armed Humanitarians, The Rise of the Nation Builders. It is published by Bloomsbury. What about Afghanistan? We were talking about nation building in Iraq, but weren't provincial reconstruction teams formed soon after the invasion of Afghanistan?
The idea, yeah, for the provincial reconstruction teams was to kind of create a way that they could extend the reach of the central government by kind of going in this counterclockwise fashion around Afghanistan. The provincial reconstruction teams really started out in Afghanistan, although there were sort of early antecedents in the Balkans, for instance. But the idea was, again, that you want to have this kind of this merger, the blurring of the lines between humanitarian and military action.
And that's why NGOs were mixed in, aid groups, diplomats as well. Didn't these groups want to be seen as independent of the U.S. military in order to gain the trust of the people? Did the people believe that they were independent of the military?
NGOs can come in lots of different flavors, and there were some that chose absolutely not to participate and not have anything to do with it. But then there are also these there are nonprofits and for-profit companies that work as contractors, essentially, for the U.S. Agency for International Development, and they have been basically brought in to be a part of this.
According to CNN, the U.S. government has spent $56 billion on major construction and public works projects in Afghanistan alone over the past decade. I don't know what the Tea Partiers think of that. But do we know where all that money has gone? Hasn't a lot of it just disappeared down some kind of a sinkhole?
Well, we have a really pretty good idea. For instance, there's roughly the same amount of money that was spent on reconstruction in Iraq. And I don't remember the exact percentage, but there was a Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction who came out with a figure that they sort of reckoned that there was a good couple billion dollars at a minimum of waste in that. And if we take that as sort of a guidepost, Afghanistan's got sort of the same kind of problems with governance and oversight. In a lot of ways, it's an even trickier place to work. We could say that there's a pretty fair chance that some of that money has been wasted as well.
And these countries were essentially considered too big to fail.
We're talking about the enormous amount of money. And if we just step back for a minute and kind of look at the resources that we put into the Department of Defense, we're roughly double what we were spending on the military about 10 years ago. Right now, the budget, including the funds that we set aside for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, is about $700 billion a year. If we look at the entire budget for the operations of the Department of State and USAID, it's only about $50 billion, roughly. So you're talking about a huge disparity of resources that we can throw at this kind of problem.
Was the effort in Afghanistan largely undercut when we invaded Iraq? I've always wondered, if we had continued the way we were going, might Afghanistan look very different today?
Well, that's you're really kind of getting to the heart of the matter there. And that's one of the reasons why there was this sort of surge of additional manpower and resources starting about a year and a half ago to Afghanistan under the new administration.
But that's
in
a
order
little
for
after
that to
late.
Work,
that's like a locking
right,
the barn door after the horse has been stolen.
Right. We need all those troops and the materiel and all that, plus a time machine, right, in order to go back to 2002 and sort of undo what was done. All those resources, basically, I was in Afghanistan I can't believe it's, you know, almost 9 years ago, in March of 2002, when one of the last big sort of set-piece military operations, Operation Anaconda, was going on. And there was sort of quiet rumbling in the background. Well, you know, don't we need more resources? Don't we need more aircraft? Do we need artillery? All these kind of questions were coming up, and there was sort of this they might kind of be needed somewhere else. You know, it really wasn't spoken of openly at the time, but it was pretty clear that, you know, that was where the planning was. That's where all the focus was. It was all going to Iraq. But we can't go back in time and clean up spilled milk.
You're critical of the military's embrace of nation building. You write that less is more, but isn't that the perception of many people around the world, that our military goes into a country, wreaks havoc, and then takes off?
I'd give you the opposite example, which was Haiti. Very few organizations other than the U.S. military can go into a situation when basically all the infrastructure is out. Electricity is down. The airport is shut down, and they can get there. They've got the manpower. They've got the ships. They've got the aircraft to get to a place in a hurry to stand things up again, get things functioning. But this was the interesting difference. They didn't end up owning Haiti. They ended up pulling out. They went from a presence of about 20,000 U.S. troops. And some commentators were saying, we're going to have 20,000 troops in Haiti from, you know, here for a very long time. within a couple of months, they were all gone.
But there weren't insurgents fighting in Haiti, and Haiti remains a very troubled situation.
That's true, but that's not primarily a problem for the military to solve. And ultimately, a lot of the problems that we're talking about here, the problems of insurgency in Afghanistan, they're political problems. You can't kill your way out of them. That's basically the argument.
But some could argue that our involvement in Haiti was a missed opportunity to address the real crisis in that country, its weak political and civil systems and the corruption and all the other things that we just had a very questionable election there. In almost every case, in fact, we've gone into these countries and helped them develop a political system that is questionable in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're so unhappy with the people who wound up being put in power largely through our help.
Again, but this needs to get to the larger issue. Is it the military that needs to be going in and doing the advising and running the show? Essentially, these are problems that people in Haiti and Afghanistan and elsewhere have to work out for themselves. And very often, if we have a heavy footprint, a very heavy U.S. presence there, it doesn't necessarily help the situation.
So what is the Pentagon rethinking its role? Because in the past, we've always heard the same cliche. We fight the last war, not right. The current war. Are we now trying to think about how we might fight the next war, implementing all of this new way of allocating military energy?
Look, there are two things that are at work right now in the Department of Defense. One is that they understand that there's so much financial pressure that they can't maintain the level of defense spending that we have. So they are going to have to scale back one way or another, and that may force a correction. The other is, the military in a lot of ways longs for, pines for, really wishes that it had that conventional adversary like they did in the Soviet Union that gave you your organizing principle. You could count the number of armored divisions they had, the number of aircraft that they had, and it was quick, it was simple, and your enemy wore uniforms. Oh, that made things easy in a lot of ways. Now they inhabit this much more complex and complicated world, and they're still trying to figure out what is the model, what is the correct way of understanding not only the war that you're in right now, but how do you plan for ones in the future? And I think there's some smart people right now who really do see the idea that again, what I say sort of in shorthand form, less is more, the idea that you try to minimize your involvement, your kind of intervention in other countries.
Well, one of the reasons we brought in – well, first of all, I have to tell everybody that my guest is Nathan Hodge. His book, Armed Humanitarians, The Rise of the Nation Builders, published by Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the past, the military did do a lot of the same things. We saw that after World War II, for example. In fact, during World War II. In Europe and then after the war in Japan. So the big difference here is privatization, isn't it? Bringing in contractors to do the sorts of things that the military used to do in the past. And some people have seen this as a major problem.
This is a lot of ways the dirty little secret of our past decades experiment in nation building. It is the outsourcing of a lot of this mission.
That's because we don't have a draft anymore.
Because we don't have a draft anymore. And were we forced to do this only with people in uniform, you might have to think about having a draft. And what would that provoke? A massive backlash. But, if you do it with people who are basically being paid well to do it and who are volunteering to do it as contractors, basically for every sort of set of boots on the ground that we have in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've got another set of contractor boots, basically people who are stepping in where maybe conscripts, where draftees would have been doing it a generation or a couple of generations ago.
Well, the Pentagon doesn't have to do an audit. What is the story with the contractors? Who are they accountable to, and did they have to account for every dollar they spent?
The big issue, there are a couple of different ways that you can come at the problem of accountability. Number one was just the accountability that you had in Iraq with CPA Order 17, which in essence, gave legal immunity. That's why he had this massive problem when there was the famous Nisour Square shooting, where a number of civilians were killed by Blackwater contractors. They were effectively exempted from local Iraqi law. But no one had really figured out in advance, well, sort of how do we hold them accountable? There are lots of different mechanisms. There's something called the Mija. There are different sort of ways that they were looking at sort of trying to bring legal accountability into it. But, you know, ultimately, they've had a really hard time overseeing just because of what I'd call the massive burn rate of these kinds of operations. I mean, I talked to young army captains who were overseeing, you know, $1 million a month in reconstruction projects. If you work in an NGO, man, that's your year's budget, I'll tell you.
Were locals invited to do any of the work that we are bringing these outside contractors in to do?
I'd sort of contrast the early days, the sort of small footprint version of nation building that I would have seen in Afghanistan in 2002. Yeah, where they were bringing in local labor to do a lot of the work. They were sort of paying them, you know, sort of low hourly wage. But the idea was, let's get everyone invested in this process. But that didn't quite square with the model that the Army had set up through a contract mechanism called LOGCAP. And LOGCAP was basically came out of the involvement in the Balkans. They contracted out to companies like KBR and DynCorp to run these enormous camps. So they followed that same model in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, that doesn't win hearts and minds, does it? Especially when unemployment is so high in these countries.
Well, you're not hiring local labor. And number two, you're flying in people from other countries. They call the so-called third country nationals, right?
Which, of course, although that's very expensive. One of the chapters in your book focuses on the cash handouts soldiers gave to Iraqis to win their favor. What were they paying them for?
Well, you could look at it in two ways. In some ways, it was a legitimate way to sort of prime the pump after there was some serious fighting. And this happened in Sadr City, of a sort of pretty rough neighborhood of Baghdad in 2008. Very intense fighting. But the idea was a lot of these local businesses had seen their inventories destroyed. So, platoon leaders, company commanders were able to give up to $2,500 each to local business owners so they could, you know, sort of restock their inventory. But the problem was, again, you know, oversight. How do you exactly know who you're giving the money to, and how do you make sure they're not double dipping?
And did people see this as an example of U.S. generosity, or did they feel they were being bought off?
Well, there was a really great example of this all came out of something which was a way of using cash initially that was confiscated from Saddam Hussein's regime. And they created this mechanism called Commander's Emergency Response Program. And all these commanders were under intense pressure to spend, because it was one metric that you could show that you are making some kind of progress, right? And the idea was, if we give them enough money, maybe they won't shoot at us. Or if you say to a neighborhood, hey, clean up the trash here, we'll pay you to do it. But if we find that there's a bomb laid in the trash, well, maybe we won't pay you that week. But so there was a simple coercive relationship there, but the idea was that it was being spent at such an enormous rate with a minimal oversight.
It seems to me the whole thing didn't work very well. The Iraqis were complaining that they didn't have electricity for much of the day when they had it during Saddam Hussein's time, that hospitals were having a hard time just operating on a normal level. In fact, pretty much everything, the whole infrastructure had fallen apart. And we went in there promising to fix all those things and didn't do a very good job. I don't even know right now whether there's electricity 24 hours a day in Baghdad.
A really good example, again, 2008 in Sadr City. One of the main problems for the brigade commander I spent a little bit of time with was local electricity, making sure that during the cooling season that people had some power. People start to get really irritated in midsummer when they don't have air conditioning. So, they were setting up these micro generators in all these different small neighborhoods. That's great. That's terrific. But that's an example of, so you put this generator in this village. Who's accountable for it? Who's going to oversee it? Who's going to pay for the fuel? The idea was that they wanted people to take ownership of these projects, but they were learning in a very compressed period of time what, you know, people in the aid and development business have known for decades. You hand somebody a fish, right? You may feed them for a day, or that fish may be sold on the black market. It's not always so easy.
So where does this leave us now? Is the solution to leave the military out of nation building altogether?
No, I think the military needs to understand how to do nation building, to do it smartly, and to do it as low impact and with as minimal force as possible. And that's one of the really one of the positive lessons that came out of all of this. They understood, especially in the sort of the U.S. version, the sort of the hearts and minds version of counterinsurgency, sometimes the less force you use, the more protected you are. And that actually has enormous implications for the innocent people who are living in a war zone.
But we're going to be pulling out of both of these countries eventually, on some level or other. Are we going to have built nations for them?
No, and again, it's because I argue the people who live in those nations have to build them for themselves. It's really hard to impose from the outside.
Yeah, but they said, you know, we were doing okay. I mean, I don't know. There was a lot of unhappiness in both Iraq and Afghanistan, but they were functioning countries, and they seem to be finding it harder to function today than they did in the past.
Look, counterinsurgency in Iraq, in a lot of ways, was, again, getting at that problem of cleaning up spilt milk and allowing the United States to basically salvage a desperate situation. But that sort of idea of counterinsurgency sort of became gospel. Well, that's what saved us in Iraq. So let's go try to let's try to reproduce that experiment again on a massive scale in Afghanistan when maybe a different strategy was called for. I can't tell you what that strategy is, but I can definitely tell you that it doesn't always work as planned.
And no one seems to have figured out Afghanistan, not going back all the way to Alexander the Great. So I guess we shouldn't be surprised that it's been a lot more difficult than anybody imagined.
But again, if you went back to 2002, 2004 in Afghanistan, it was really an optimistic time in a lot of ways. But it was just that you saw the very beginnings of this downward spiral in violence that it's been involved in now.
Nathan Hodge's book is Armed Humanitarians, The Rise of the Nation Builders. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.